News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, an interview with the executive editor for Gourmet Magazine, John Willoughby. But in these 2 minutes, we need to take a little time here to bring you an important message. We're asking you for your help this week here on AM 580. We're asking you to support this public radio station. Your financial contributions keep the programs you enjoy on the air. I'm Celeste Quinn, and with me today in Pledge Central, Rita Schulte. Good afternoon, Rita.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
We've got a sweet deal this afternoon.
We do, and we've all been oogling and drooling over this thank you gift. The 1,000 recipes collected from Gourmet Magazine, which is going to be spoken of, I believe, by our guest coming up in this hour of the Afternoon Magazine. And it's a beautiful cookbook. And they haven't spent a lot of time on huge, glossy pictures. It is information dense. If you want to know how to cook anything, I think it's probably in this book, including some tutorials on properly cooking some very common things that you never really thought about how good they could taste if they were cooked correctly. I'd like to update you. We have raised $50,000 so far in our
pledge.
Terrific. That's very exciting. And we want to say thank you to everyone. And I wish I had the time and the list of all your names, because it's a wonderful thing that you've done for us so far. 508 pledges, Celeste, since Saturday.
Great.
And we want to encourage you, if you want a copy of the book, we have four of them at a pledge level of $120. Make sure you tell the volunteer that you're interested in this cookbook, because once, I believe, our guest speaks about this, they will go fast.
Right, right. And $120 pledge is $10 a month. It's a terrific deal. And not only do you get the book if you're one of the first four callers to call in with a pledge of $120, but what else do we have on the table? We've got Patterns Magazine.
We do.
And the member card.
We have the WILL member card, which entitles you at the $75 level to entrees at a number of restaurants around the state of Illinois, and also many online shopping opportunities. And if you're like me, you love flowers and you're a terrible gardener, you can. There's a website that is participating, and you can use your member card every time you go to this website. It's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to use this to send someone flowers, even if it's yourself.
Yeah, or put them on the table when you've cooked a beautiful meal from the
Absolutely.
Gourmet cookbook.
Mm-hmm. And they come to you with a vase and instructions, and generally within 24 hours of the order, and they're beautiful.
Okay, so $120 will get you the Gourmet cookbook, will get you the member card, will get you a subscription to Patterns Magazine, our monthly program guide.
And will help us support public radio
That's
for another year.
That's the most important
thing.
Listener support comprises almost half of our income here at WILL. Okay, Rita, well, we'll let you go.
Okay.
And we'll keep in touch. Let's remind folks of the phone number, though.
217-244-9455. And they can go online as well, Celeste.
Okay, and that would be WILL.UIUC.edu. And again, the phone number is 217. That's the area code. And the number to call with a pledge of financial support, 244-9455. That's 244-WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a conversation with one of the country's most respected food writers, John Doc Willoughby. He's now the executive editor at Gourmet. He was part of the team, headed by Ruth Reichel, that gathered together the best recipes the magazine has published over the last 60 years, retested them, and put them between the covers of a book that contains more than 1,000 recipes. Listeners, I invite you to join our conversation this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. John Willoughby is the author of 8 cookbooks, including Thrill of the Grill. Before signing on at Gourmet, he was a regular contributor to many cooking magazines, including Cooks Illustrated and the New York Times. He appears regularly on the NPR program, The Splendid Table, and he appears regularly on the PBS show, America's Test Kitchen. 2 of the chapters particularly important for John Willoughby are the chapters that deal with meat in this book, the chapter poultry and the chapter beef, veal, pork, and lamb. The Gourmet Cookbook, published by Houghton Mifflin, and the number to call with a question or comment, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. John Willoughby, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. My pleasure.
Sure. Well, tell us, how did you get that nickname, Doc? Is it about recipes?
No.
Oh,
this happened many years ago. I grew up in Iowa, in a small town in Iowa, and I came to college out east, and my roommate was from Manhattan, and I don't really know to this day what exactly it was, but I walked in the room, and he said, "Hi, Doc." And I said, "What? What? My name is John." He said, "No, you're a country doctor." And for some reason, it stuck, and all these years later, I suspect it was my collection of pastel V-neck sweaters. I don't know.
Oh, I was imagining it was because you were a whiz at fixing up recipes.
Well, that would be good. I think I'll use that now.
Yeah. Ruth Reichel mentions being 7 years old and in her mother's kitchen in her introduction to the Gourmet Cookbook. And I know from her book, Tender at the Bone, one of the reasons she became interested in food was, quite frankly, out of self-defense. What led you to your interest in food?
Well, I'd always been pretty interested in food. My father was a great cook, and he used to read cookbooks as if they were fiction. He would lie on the couch and read cookbooks. So I always had a sort of an idea that cookbooks were important books and cooking was important. But what really got me into the world of food professionally was I took a trip after I quit a job I had had for quite a number of years, sold my car and took the money and just went traveling. And I flew to London, and we ended up going down through England, through France, Spain, and Portugal, across North Africa to Italy, then to Greece, and ended up in Istanbul, where I ran out of money. And during that trip, I had the most amazing food. It was so different and so eye-opening. It was just wonderful. That all those Mediterranean foods just made me feel like this was what I wanted to be involved with.
Yeah. And that trip, did it influence your taste, your approach to food and cooking?
Absolutely, because we were eating street food. We didn't have a lot of money, and so, you know, we were eating the food that was very often grilled, very often highly spiced, and it really, I wasn't familiar with that kind of food at all, that sort of casual but really flavorful, great food. My idea had been that food was either sort of Midwestern food, or it was French. I didn't know that there was this whole world of really simple but exotically flavored foods.
Yeah. You know, for as long as I can remember seeing the magazine, the Gourmet magazine, travel and the foods of places near and far have really been at the heart of its identity. Has that aspect of the magazine been constant?
It has been pretty constant since the magazine started. The magazine was begun back in 1941, and in the 40s, they had a lot of recipes from all over the world. It was amazing. We found sushi recipes in the magazine in the 40s. They had recipes from Thailand, from Argentina. It really has been sort of the signature approach of the magazine.
Who were the magazine's first readers? Who was in the 1940s who wanted to know about sushi?
Well, the magazine was originally much more of a hunting and fishing kind of magazine. It was had a very large male readership. The original publisher was a big hunter and fisher. And the recipes back then are very comical if you look at them today. They had no ingredient lists, and they were recipes for possum and raccoon and bear. And they would start out, cook 3 pheasants, and that would be sort of the beginning of the recipe. There was no instruction. It was very much more of a kind of outdoorsy magazine. And then over the years, it started becoming more of a sort of cooking magazine for regular cooks.
Yeah. So just today, it runs the gamut then for readership, huh?
It does. We have our readers really do run the gamut of all, you know, from young to old, men, women. And in the book, we really tried to reflect that and include recipes that were good for beginning cooks and recipes that were good for cooks who were accomplished and looking for something really fun to make.
Hmm. When you started cooking, what kind of things did you make at the outset?
Well, when I started cooking, I actually had this book called The Flavor Principle, which is out of print now. And it had recipes from all over the world simplified for American cooks using the flavor principles of various cuisines around the world. And I cooked, I think, every single recipe in that book. Some of them I still cook today, and that was 20-some years ago.
Wow.
So I really started out looking at, you know, cuisines from around the world as what I was interested in.
Hmm. Over the course of those two decades that you've been cooking, what changes have you seen in how we cook and our tastes in food that you think have been grand improvements, and what have you seen that you've thought is just pretty dreadful?
Well, it was interesting going back and testing the old recipes. Some of the people who work here in the food, in the test kitchens, have been here over 30 years, and so they would remember these recipes as just, we must have this shrimp de jong recipe. It's so delicious. And we would go back and taste it, and we couldn't eat it because it had so much butter in it. And really, I know that America has become a much fatter nation over these years, but I really think that is from fast food, because if you go back, we used a lot more butter and cream in the old days than we can stand now. We really had to lighten up a lot of the recipes, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, at least to our taste buds, you know, and for our health, it's a good thing. And the availability of authentic ingredients, of herbs and spices from around the world, of ingredients from around the world, is so much better now than it was 20 years ago. It's just, you can't even imagine. 20 years ago, you couldn't find fish sauce. There just wasn't any, and now it's pretty regularly available. And herbs, spices, all those things are so much more available now, which is a great thing. One of the things I think has not been so good, although it's probably better for our health, is the way that meat has changed over the years. It's now, particularly pork, but also to a certain extent beef, much leaner than it used to be, so it's much less flavorful.
Yeah, that was interesting. When you retested the old recipes for meat, you found you were dealing with entirely new animals.
Oh, absolutely. If you cooked pork roast today the way your grandmother cooked it, it would be like a piece of sawdust, I mean, like a little roll of sawdust. It is so much, it's almost 50% leaner. So it really requires a very different approach to cooking it.
Yeah. So braising would be a good option, would it not?
Braising is the best. I'm a huge fan of braising because those cuts of meat that you braise, those tough, kind of gnarly cuts of meat, are much more flavorful, because in meat there's an inverse relationship between flavor and texture. The more tender a piece of meat starts out, the less flavor it's going to have when it's cooked. So these kind of difficult cuts of meat, often from the shoulder, that you cook a really long time, as you cook them, they become very, very tender because the connective tissues in them melt and become like a sort of jelly that makes the meat much more tender. And they also have much more flavor. And if you needed another recommendation, they're also the cheaper cuts. So
yeah.
We love those.
Yeah. What is braising exactly?
It's just basically the dish people are most familiar with in America as a braised dish is pot roast. So it's really just like making a pot roast. It's cooking a tough cut of meat in an enclosed container in a little bit of liquid, usually about enough liquid to come halfway up the side of whatever you're cooking. So that you're cooking partially by steam and partially by hot liquid. It's a very moist cooking method, which is what causes all those collagens to melt.
And do you need to brown the meat first?
I do.
Yeah.
I really recommend it because the process of browning something, the interaction of the proteins in the meat with the heat, creates literally in a piece of beef hundreds of new flavor compounds that you can only create by browning. So if you brown that piece of meat before you put it into the liquid and cook it for 2 or 3 or 4 hours, not only does the meat become more flavorful, but that flavor gets distributed during the cooking process all through the cooking liquid. So I really think it's an essential step.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, John Doc Willoughby. He's now executive editor at Gourmet, and he was part of the team headed by Ruth Reichel that gathered together the best recipes the magazine has published over the last 60 years, retested them, and then put them between the covers of a new book that contains more than 1,000 recipes, The Gourmet cookbook published by Houghton Mifflin. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us with questions, comments about cooking for our guest, John Doc Willoughby. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You were kind of alluding to some kind of like ethnic recipes, possum and things like that. I've noticed at the supermarket they have tripe and pork fries and all kinds of things like that, but I have no idea where to start with something like that. I'm just wondering, do you have any recipes that you'd like to share with us that might cover some of those types of items in the supermarket?
We do have quite a few recipes in the book for, I think they have the term these days for meats like that is variety meats, things that are may not be familiar with, but they're usually quite cheap and they're a little bit exotic. We have we didn't do a lot of recipes like that, but we wanted to have one or two for each one. So we do have, for example, a tripe recipe in there, which we got in Rome. Our test cooks, each of them goes for 2 weeks every year, just traveling to some country to get interesting recipes and ideas. And one of our test cooks found basically it's a tripe with in a tomato sauce. And if you cook tripe right, it's one of those things that if you cook it right, it's tender and flavorful and wonderful. And if you don't cook it right, you wouldn't want to eat it. But this is a great tripe recipe.
Is the caller still there?
Yeah, I'm there. Are you forthcoming with it?
Do we have time to read it on the air?
If you'd like to kind of give us maybe sort of the kind of sum it up for us a little bit more than just the tomato sauce. What can you tell us about it?
Well, first of all, tripe takes a little work. So you have to boil it, drain it, and rinse it, and then you do that again. And if you don't do that, it's a little too strong flavored and also a little too tough. So you do that twice, and then you simmer the tripe for about 4 hours. Again, this is one of those things that you need to have a day to do. It doesn't take a lot of your actual time, but it takes a lot of time. And this is typical of these tougher cuts that they have to cook for a long time. Then you cook it a bunch of the standard aromatics, onion, carrots, celery, garlic, and you just soften those. And then you add some white wine in this case, and you boil that down a little to concentrate the flavor. You put in the tomatoes, and then you cook that all for about 30 minutes because you want it all to sort of all the flavors to meld together. Then you basically put in the tripe, cook it again for about half an hour to 45 minutes. You can cook it longer than that, and it'll get sort of mushy, but I like the texture to have just a little bit of chew. So if you cook for about 45 minutes, it'll still have a little chew, and the flavor will be distributed throughout all that tomato sauce, and there's aromatics, and that's basically it.
Okay.
Is that something you could work in like a crock pot, or does it have to be?
Oh, yeah, definitely you could do that in a crock pot. Crock pot is great for these long cooking things.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call. You know, it's exciting to go to the supermarket these days and find things that you've never seen before in the market and then turn to a book and get something completely new on the table.
Right. Well, what Ruth has always said about this book from the beginning was, I want this to be a book where I can go to the supermarket, pick out something I don't know anything about, come home, and get a great recipe for it. So we've got something for everything.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. This listener is on a cell phone on line number 3. Good afternoon. Line 3, are you there? No? Well, let's go on to another. Sometimes cell phones, have a funny way of cutting out. Let's turn to a listener in Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if the guest could give more information about the change from Good Old Boy cookbook, I guess, to what it was. He went through it very quickly. If he knew the history of it, I'd like to know a little more about that, whether it was change of publisher or, change at the top in some way, or readers' letters or marketing procedures, or just, exactly what happened.
Well, I can take you through it quickly through the years. It started out, as I said, it was the project of a man who liked to hunt and cook and eat. And he ran the magazine out of a penthouse in a hotel in New York, and it was a very personal magazine. And that's when there was a lot of hunting and fishing in it. And then he kept control of the magazine for quite a number of years. But after World War II, it started to be more about travel. And as the writers and people who worked at the magazine traveled more internationally, it started to be more international recipes. And then in the 50s, it began to have more writing. So there were longer articles about foods and about things that people had discovered in their travels. In the 50s, we found that recipes were not all that interesting. It's the one decade we really didn't find much to put in the book from that decade, because it was either kind of old-fashioned or it was kind of faux French, kind of silly recipes. We really didn't find a lot from the 50s, but when the 60s came around, started seeing a lot more fresh vegetables, a lot more American-style recipes, much more interesting, and also a return to more of this kind of exotic recipes. In the 70s, it sort of continued in that way. That it became more lush in terms of photography. That's when we started to see a lot of the photography, food photography and entertaining issues that the magazine sort of became known for. And then the 6.5 years ago, Ruth Reichel came from the New York Times restaurant reviewing position she had had and took over the magazine and has brought us sort of more up to date in terms of what people are eating today and where they're traveling today. And all over half of the recipes in the magazine today and also in the book are recipes that can be made in 30 minutes of actual cooking time. I mean, you may have to leave it in the oven or boil water, but actual involved cooking time, 30 minutes or less, which is a big change from the old days when almost all the recipes were very elaborate.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. That's a pretty interesting history. Let's go next to a caller in Downs, Illinois, on line 2. Hi.
Hello. I had an experience recently. I teach cooking classes for a shop in a nearby community. And a couple of years ago, I taught a braising class, and I think I had probably used a chuck roast. And I went back to do that for a soup class, and I don't cook a lot of beef. We're not vegetarians, but I do kind of a minimal amount of meat. And I found that in the supermarket, I couldn't find anything with bones.
Really?
The bones were gone. I cannot hear you.
Yeah, I'm a little bit surprised, although, you know, meat is certainly packaged and processed a lot differently these days than it was. So it all comes cryovac'd in, you know, primary cuts and then is cut up there.
They called it customer-friendly.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of what they call customer-friendly, which is boned meats very often with marinades already on them.
Yeah.
Cryovac'd, and that stuff is just, I can't eat it. So
what can we do about this? Because a braising cut, you lose so much of the flavor.
No, you need something on the bone. Now, that's always, you know, scientifically, there are good reasons why the bone adds a ton of flavor to anything you're going to cook, particularly for a long period of time. So it's a very distressing development for those of us who love to cook meat, and I'm only hoping that if people like you, you know, complain to their supermarkets,
well,
go back.
I did, except that they don't cut anything there, and they just kind of shrug and say, well, that's the way we get it.
I know. It's a bad development. It's really, you know, if you live in a city or many actually towns, you might have a butcher, but if you don't, you know,
right,
it's really getting hard to find a decent piece of meat.
Yeah, there is somebody here, but I don't see that lasting a really long time.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that it won't go further in that direction, but so far it's not been too good.
I'm hoping that books like yours maybe show people that, you know, how to cook these things.
Let's hope. I mean, one of the things that we would like the book to do is to bring more people back to cooking, you know, every night, because it's not that hard, and back to cooking some of the things that they might not have thought of for a while, you know. A lot of people, you know, they cook hamburgers, which is great, and steaks, which is great, but people have kind of forgotten about brisket and chuck shoulder roast and all those great things that were more prevalent in the past. So we're hoping that people go back to them.
I want to second your thing about browning.
Oh, great.
My mother-in-law, who was the blandest cook in the world, she was in California, but she came from the Midwest, and she was very Midwesterner. I had never seen an herb or a spice in her life, I don't think, made the best pot roast because she just browned the hell out of it.
Yep, that's what it takes.
And, you know, even if she just threw the onion soup on it and did it that way, which was popular at the time, it was still just had a great flavor, and it was all the browning.
Absolutely. One of my favorite recipes in this book, actually, is you take a big chuck roast, you put it in a, you know, you brown it, put it in a pot with a mushed up can of canned tomatoes and a head of garlic, and that's it. cook it for 3 hours, and the flavor is amazing.
Yeah, she wouldn't have even done the tomatoes and garlic.
Just plain. Still good.
Okay, thank you. I'm looking forward to seeing the book.
Thanks.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Other telephone calls are invited. You can join the conversation about cooking this afternoon with John Doc Willoughby of Gourmet Magazine by giving us a telephone call. And we look forward to your calls. Questions and comments are invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. My name is Celeste Quinn, and again, our guest this afternoon, John Doc Willoughby. He's one of the people behind the team for the Gourmet Cookbook published by Houghton Mifflin. You know, one of the things that I'm enjoying about reading this cookbook is that not only is it good for wherever you are on the spectrum in terms of how good a cook you are, if you're a beginner, if you're an intermediate kind of person, or if you're an advanced cook, I think it's a great reference.
Well, that's what we were aiming at. We wanted this to be a book that you could get when you got out of college and didn't know how to cook at all, and that would grow with you through your whole life as a cook, so that you could take on, there'd be a lot of things you could cook very easily, and you could graduate to more and more sort of elaborate dishes. We really concentrated on making the directions totally clear to even a novice cook. And one of the ways we did that was when the recipes had all been endlessly tested and we thought they were perfect, we then brought in what we called the cross tester, who is an experienced home cook but not a professional and not no one who ever worked in a restaurant or anything, and had him cook them. And he often found there were confusions, things, places where he wasn't sure what to do, because professional cooks have a sort of shorthand in how they write about things. So I think in the end, we ended up with recipes that pretty much anybody can follow.
Yeah. One of the best cooks in my family is an aunt. And when I got out of school, I asked her, what would you recommend? What's your favorite cookbook? And by this point in her life, she really didn't rely too much anymore on cookbooks. But she told me, find one that you like, that you enjoy, and then really stick with it till you know it.
Yep, that's great advice.
That's really good advice. But when you're looking for that cookbook, or when you're looking at a recipe and you're looking at it for the first time, what kind of advice can you give us in terms of sizing it up?
It's hard to do because there are a lot of recipes that, are written well but don't work. It's really hard. I think you just have to, read it through. And it's always good to read a recipe through before you try to make it. Read it through. See if it seems clear to you. Look at the ingredient list. See if it matches up with what they're talking about. You really just sort of have to trust your gut on whether it seems right to you. And then, try a few and see if they work. See if they're to your taste. If there's no, really with a cookbook, unfortunately, there's no substitute for actually trying some of the recipes.
Yeah, and some of the recipes, I think this is nice to be able to rely on your book as well, the Gourmet Cookbook. There's a little note after many, many recipes, and it'll say on this recipe, even though it seems fussy, please use exactly what we've called for here.
Right.
And other things you can kind of, if you don't have something.
We figure people, particularly experienced cooks, will, improvise. They'll look at this recipe, and if they don't have something, they'll substitute something else for it, and usually that's great. But there are times when you have to have actually what we call for, or you're not going to get the recipe that we had in mind and the recipe that you're really going to like. So when there's a situation like that, we specify it so that you won't be tempted to sort of freelance within the recipe. And we also, if there's anything that can be done ahead, we always put that in a note at the end of the recipe, because everybody's trying to do things, as efficiently as possible these days. And a lot of times you can make components of the recipe on the weekend and cook them a couple days later. So we always put that at the end of the recipe.
What are your favorite recipes for stew? Because this is something that you can do a lot on a weekend, and you can spend a little extra time in the kitchen, and then you can enjoy it.
Right. There are a lot of really great stew recipes, and one of my favorites is it's called a tagine, because it's inspired by a Moroccan recipe, but it's a lamb tagine with prunes, apricots, and vegetables. And it's pretty simple. I'm a big fan of lamb, which I think is really not appreciated enough in America. And it's pretty simple, but it's got a lot of flavor because it's got those the kind of combination of earthiness, aromatic spices, and sweetness that's typical of North African cooking. So if I were looking for, you know, a single stew recipe, that would be the one I might try first.
Yeah. When it comes to lamb, talk with us about lamb. What do we need to know? What are the basics, and what kind, what cut would be best for stew?
Well, lamb has changed less than most other meats. The main change that's come about in American lamb over the last 20 years is as they've gotten bigger. But really, they haven't changed too much other than that. Lamb is pretty straightforward. The thing to watch out for in lamb is that I like, for example, the taste of pork fat and beef fat, but lamb fat is chemically different than those. It's a hard fat. So you want to trim off most of the fat when you're cooking lamb because it's not as pleasing either to the taste or to the texture as a fat from other animals. So you need to be a little careful about that. If you were making a stew, you can use the leg of lamb, very easy to get a hold of, and it makes a decent stew meat. But if you can get a shoulder cut, it's going to be better because it's got, again, it's going to hold up longer just as a shoulder of a cow would. A beef shoulder, it's going to hold up better over a long cooking time. And so the cut I like best for lamb stews is shoulder chops, which are pretty easy to find. And they're the first cut in the shoulder as you come from where the other chops come from. On the rib section, so they've got a little bit of tenderness, but they've also got the sort of deep flavor of the shoulder. So that's my particular favorite cut for stews.
Oh, that sounds great. And beef, what cut do you like for a beef stew or a beef stroganoff?
Chuck is perfect for stews. I mean, chuck is still about the cheapest cut of beef, and it's a fattier and sort of better for long cooking. So for a stew, I would always go for a chuck. For stroganoff, I might use something a little more tender. I might use a cut from the rib area, although the shoulder would also be okay for stroganoff. I might even use a round cut, a cut from the like a round roast to make stroganoff.
Hmm. You know, thinking of meat, and you mentioned that you enjoy a taste of a little of the fat in beef and pork. This is something, too, that they're doing at the supermarket, is they're cutting all that off of your roasts.
It's true. Really, I mean, the kind of meat you get in the supermarket these days really are not what they should be. You don't have a lot of choice in terms of how much fat do you want, do you want the bone or not. It's all pre-cut, and it's standardized, and I really think that is doing the customers and cooks a disservice, and we're all hoping that the industry goes back more to, you know, letting you make some decisions about what you want them to cut for you.
Yeah. You know, you can always ask them to cut it off, or you can do it at home. But I made a special order once for a beef roast, and I asked them what I want. I told them what I wanted, and I said, please leave the cap on. And then when I went to pick it up, the man said, well, I trimmed that right up for you, just to be helpful.
Very irritating.
And I almost cried.
I know. It's like, you know, one thing they usually sometimes leave the fat cap on is brisket. I've done a lot of cooking, and we do a lot of brisket recipes because they do tend to leave the fat on that for you.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Just a quick thing that I do with cookbook. I write on them. I say, no, use less of sugar or whatever it is, or this needs spicing, or this is terrific. And then I also say I added bok choy, or I do a lot of Chinese cooking.
Mm.
And so, you know, or I put a big X to deep frying part of it and just know I'm going to stir fry it. So
I think it's absolutely great. And those are the cookbooks that you love, you know.
I use them, and I've
cooked you use
like
them.
That.
I still have my grandmother's cookbook, which she wrote in the margins, you know, and it's like it really makes it great. Not only it's sort of a personal reminder of her, but it also, you know, I know exactly how to cook those recipes because she wrote all the little hints.
Exactly right. I always think of that, and that makes a big difference. And it reminds me the next time I look at it, because I don't always follow the recipes, what I did that made it better or what I found that I didn't like.
Absolutely. That's the best thing to do is personalize your own cookbook.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't want to mess it up because it's...
Well, you know, this book, Gourmet Magazine is well known for having a lot of beautiful food photography. This book has no pictures, no photos in it because we wanted it to be a book that you put on the kitchen counter and you can write in. You know, you can spill on it. It's a book to cook out of and to make your own.
I think that's too bad because I have now two Chinese cookbooks that I really like, and the photographs, it's an art form of our time. Food photography can be gorgeous. I salivate.
It can be, but you would find in 2 years that it would look old-fashioned to you. So this,
no.
Yeah, I've been working in the cookbook business for 15 years,
yeah.
And you'll find, I look back now at the books we did 3 years ago, and they're like, they look old-fashioned. So if you want a book to be a classic, it's hard to put photos in it, but it certainly can be enticing.
It does work for me. Well, thanks. Bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to talk with us. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I guess the secret here, or one idea here, would be to rely on the cooking magazines for what the latest food fashion is and how things look and
right.
How beautiful they are. But then your old friend that you've got in the kitchen on the counter that you use over and over and over again.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you can do without the pictures. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon is John Doc Willoughby. He is a food writer. He's now executive editor at Gourmet Magazine. He was part of the team that put together a cookbook, the Gourmet Cookbook, which is over 1,000 recipes. And what they did was they went through 60 years of the magazine, and they pulled up recipes. They retested them, and then they collect them into this book, the Gourmet Cookbook. What surprised you most, do you suppose, during this process of looking back and testing, retesting these recipes?
Well, I think what we sort of forget, and so it ends up being very surprising, is how limited the ingredients were even 20 years ago that you could find in most markets. We look back at some of the Chinese recipes that the magazine did 25 years ago, and there's no fresh ginger, there's no cilantro, there's no, some of them didn't even have soy sauce. There's certainly no fish sauce in the Southeast Asian recipes. It was very limited, so the recipes, while they were good for what they were, they really didn't have the right flavors for what they were supposed to be, and that has changed so dramatically over the last 20 years. It's like a different world of cooking.
Yeah. Was it easy or difficult to decide what to keep and what to toss?
Well, we started out saying we were going to have 800 recipes in the book, because we thought that was plenty, and we ended up having 1,283 because we just could not, there were so many we just couldn't exclude. And we met every day pretty much for 3 years to look at the recipes, compare them. We would have bake-offs. You know, we started out with 30 cheesecakes. Well, you can't have 30 cheesecakes. We had narrowed it down to 30. We thought that was good. But that's, you know, it's just ridiculous. And our editors at Houghton Mifflin kept saying, no, fewer. So, and they were right. So we ended up with 11 cheesecakes, which is still a lot. But in order to do that, we had to have cook-offs, and we would cook 3 cheesecakes a day and compare them to each other and then figure out which ones absolutely had to be in the book. So it was a long process. It was great fun, particularly for those of us who were testing instead of cooking. But, it was hard.
Yeah, boy. I don't know how you work on a project like this and keep the magazine going at the same time.
Well, it was long hours.
Long hours, yeah. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Will County, on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing great. I just was listening to your show, and I was enjoying every bit of it here, and I just wanted to throw something out at you. I do a lot of the cooking in my house, and I farm, so I'm busy with that a lot, too, and you guys might think this is a little maybe on the gross side, but as far as browning the meat and all that, I mean, because I'm on a time budget a lot, I'll take a roast out of the freezer, throw it right on the grill, and brown it, and it looks like a perfectly cooked roast. But it's froze harder than a rock, and then I've wrapped it up in foil and thrown it in the oven with tomatoes and peppers and onions and everything and forget about it for 3 or 4 hours, and it turns out perfect.
Wow. Now, I've never tried that, but now I'm going to.
I think maybe I'll start a cookbook called Caveman Cooking or something like that.
That's very interesting. You know, it might. Well, obviously it works. You know?
And people laugh at me. They say, "Oh, you cannot cook frozen meat." Well, yeah, I'll admit it's probably a whole lot better if it's thawed out, but it works out great.
Hey, if it, it works,
really
it works.
It works out great, but like I said, I'll take it out and it smells like a rock. I throw it on the grill and brown it, and it really seals everything in, like your previous caller said. I think it works out great.
No, interesting. That's a good, that's a new technique.
There you go. Either right or wrong, but it's new.
We'll have to give that a try.
There you go.
Well, thanks for your call
this afternoon. And I enjoy all your programming down there.
Oh, well, you're very welcome, and thanks for calling us again. Thank you very much for that that word. That's really interesting. I suppose, you know, the only real difference there in between braising, you know, on the stove and putting it in the oven is what he's got liquid in there. He's browning it. The only difference is it's frozen and it's going to take a while to cook it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to have to give that a try. Yeah. Never thought of trying to brown frozen meat, but I'm not quite sure why it wouldn't work, so we'll try it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I'm looking forward to trying is you've got some turkey recipes, and you know Thanksgiving is coming up pretty quickly, and
coming right around.
And I would have never thought to cook a bird upside down.
Well, you know, it's we've done a turkey at least once a year for 60 years, so there's a lot. They've tried just about everything, and it actually works great because it keeps the breast meat from cooking overcooking, which is the problem with the turkey. So since it's facing down, it really works great.
Yeah, sounds great. And before we go, maybe you would mention a dish or two in here that, you know, as we've been talking a lot about things that take a long while to cook, and I think we're at that point in the year we're ready to do that, go into the kitchen and spend some time because the weather is so raw here.
Mm.
But if like this gentleman who just called, who said, you know, time is of the essence, can you give us an example or two of something we can find in this book that we can, you know, we can get going quickly and get to the table and make everybody happy?
No, absolutely. I think over 600 of the recipes take 30 minutes active time or less. So pasta is always a great option when you're in a hurry. And one of my favorites is a pasta with capers, garlic, and breadcrumbs, which takes less than 20 minutes. But it's got a lot of flavor in it. You fry the capers by themselves so they get crispy. And then between the capers and the breadcrumbs, you've got a lot of texture as well as flavor, and the garlic deepens that flavor. That's a really great quick recipe. One that I've made probably 15 times in the last few months is shrimp and corn and basil, and that's all it is. Shrimp, you saute the shrimp, you put in corn and basil, which give it a nice, bright, fresh flavors. The combination is really a little bit unusual, but really great, and that, again, takes maybe 12 to 15 minutes. Where are some of my other favorites?
One more, because we gotta wrap it up, unfortunately.
Okay, fresh mushroom soup, 15 minutes. It's great. It's got a deep, rich flavor. It's not too heavy. It's really a perfect fall dish.
What's the base of that?
It's just mushrooms cooked in chicken stock with a little bit of cream.
Sounds great. Thank you, John.
Thank you. It's been fun.
John Doc Willoughby has been our guest here this afternoon on The Afternoon Magazine. He's a food writer, now the executive editor at Gourmet Magazine, one of the folks behind the Gourmet Cookbook published by Houghton Mifflin. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and this week, not only are we doing what we do generally here on The Afternoon Magazine, we're also trying to raise some money so we can keep doing what we do. Jack Brighton is with me in the studio. He's our director of Internet Operations. How are we doing, Jack?
Doing good. Great interview, I must say. I found a lot of great ideas from that. I wanted to mention we have one book left.
Ooh.
So if you get in your pledge call right now at $120 level pledge, $10 a month, 244-9455, a lot of numbers there, that's the most important one. The phone number, 217-244-9455. The next person who makes a $120 pledge at that number will get a copy of this book.
Okay, and our congratulations and thanks to all those who called in and picked up a cookbook for themselves this afternoon. Do we have time to go to Pledge Central?
Yeah, let's see how we're doing over there. Rita Schulte, membership director, is there.
Standing by. Rita, she's coming right in, dialing her up.
There she is.
Hi. We still have, as you said, one cookbook left at the $120 level.
Let's hear the phone ring now.
Uh-huh. No. Okay, but soon, I'm sure. And there you go.
There we go.
Thank you. A little time later.
Yeah, well, you know, it takes me a little longer to get that, you know, Joss going. But 217-244-9455, it really isn't us that make the phones ring. You know, it's those of you out there who help support this station. And we'd like to thank each and every one of you. We updated our dollar total a little while ago. And if you just tuned in, we're at $50,000 and a little. And we're trying to get to $55,000 by the end of the day. So your call right now can help keep us on track toward meeting our overall goal for the year, to help continue to bring you great radio, the kind of thing you expect when you tune on the dial to WILL.
As my grandmother would say, we're cooking with gas here this afternoon.
Absolutely.
Okay. 217-244-9455. Our thanks this afternoon to everyone who has called to support the programs of AM 580. Also, our thanks this afternoon to the folks at Gourmet Magazine for donating these books so that we could give them away to our supporters. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Indeed they are, Celeste. And November soybeans, very impressive today, taking out last week's high as well as closing a downward gap that was left from a week ago. We'll get to the particulars in the soybean pit, but first let's go ahead and look at the wheat. A lot of green all across the complexes today. December wheat, a high price on the day of 320 and three quarters, a low of 313 and a quarter, settling 319 and a quarter, up 4.5 on the day. March, a high of 321 and a half, a low of 324 and a half, settling 329 and three quarters, up 3.25. May wheat, a high of 335 and a quarter, a low of 329 and a half, settling 334, up 3.5. July, a high of 338 and a half, a low of 332 and a half, settling 337 and three quarters, up 4.25. And September wheat, a high of 343 and a half, a low of 339, settling 343 and a quarter, up 3.75 on the day. December corn, a high of 208, a low of 202 and three quarters, settling 207, up 3. March, a high of 218, a low of 313 and a half, settling 217, up 2.5. May, a high of 225, a low of 220 and three quarters, settling 224, up 2.25. July, a high of 230 and three quarters, a low of 227 and a quarter, settling at 230 and a quarter, up 2. September, a high of 237 and a half, a low of 235 and a quarter, settling 236 and three quarters, up 1.5. And December, the red line, up 245 on a high, a low of 243, settling 245 and a quarter, up 1 on the day. December oats, a high of 148, a low of 143, settling 145 and a half, up 2 and a quarter. The March oats contract also up 2 and a quarter on the day, a high there of 153 and a half, a low of 151 and a half, settling at 152 and a half. And then the engine that drove the Chicago Board of Trade higher throughout the day, that soybean complex. November beans, a high of 529, a low of 514 and a half, settling 527 and three quarters, up 13. January, a high of 533 and a half, a low of 519 and a half, settling 532 and a quarter, up 12. March beans, a high of 538, a low of 525, settling 537 and three quarters, up 11.5. May, a high of 544, a low of 532, settling 543 and a quarter, up 11. July, a high of 550, a low of 538, settling 549, up 11.5 on the day. December soybean meal, a high of 157.30, a low of 154.30, settling 156.80, up 270. January, a high of 158.50, a low of 155.50, settling 158.10, up 290. December soybean oil, a high of 20.72, a low of 19.96, settling 20.67, up 58. And January, a high of 20.88, a low of 20.18, settling 20.83, up 54 on the day. Prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where it was another higher day, except for one contract, Celeste, that being the October cattle feeder.
Right, and that is absolutely true. And lean hogs And Bally is up nicely again today. October feeder cattle, 113.70, the high, 113.30, the low. Finishing at 113.40, that down 37 and a half. November, 112.55, the high, 111.80, the low, 112.30, the settlement, that up 2 and a half. January feeders, 109.80, the high, 109.17 and a half, the low, finishing at 109.70, that up 37 and a half. October live cattle, 87.90, the high, the low, 87.35, finishing at 87.85, up 22 and a half. December live cattle, 89.15, the high, 88.57 and a half, the low, the settlement, 89.05, that unchanged. December lean hogs, 66.75, the high, 65.10, the low, 66.50, the settlement, that up 140. February, 67, even the high, 65.42 and a half, the low, 66.90, the settlement, that up 140. April lean hog, 64.97 and a half, the high, 63.45, the low, 64.65, the settlement, that up 120. May, 65.20, the high, 64.35, the low, the settlement, 65.15, that up $1.22.5. And February bellies, 94.65, the high, 92.65, the low, 94.52.5, the settlement, that up 27 and a half. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 36 points at 99.20. The NASDAQ off 7 at 19.30. The S&P 500 down 8 points at 11.06.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Dorothy Chandler from Madison, Wisconsin writes, "Dear Dr. Science, where did barn swallows live before people had barns?"
They lived in motels and were referred to, quite naturally, as motel swallows. A lot of what goes on in your average motel is hard to swallow, but that never stopped the aggressive little birds who didn't care where they parked their feathers as long as they had cable TV and an ice machine nearby. Incidentally, a century ago, before the hotel gave way to the motel, these birds were called flying rats and were thought to spread rabies. This reputation was merely a 19th century overreaction to hedonistic and self-centered lifestyles. But nowadays, such behavior is the norm. But back on the farm, well, it would have been appropriate only in the barn.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with new CD, screensaver for PCs, and a master's degree mouse pad, $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where U of I students appear on stage in the Department of Theater productions of Shakespeare's King Lear and the original improvisatory piece Lush Life, the School of Music production of Mozart's opera Don Giovanni, and the Department of Dance presentation November Playhouse Dance. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn, our technical director today, Jason Croft, the producer for the Afternoon Magazine, Harriet Williamson. 1 minute before 2 o'clock, 49 degrees in Urbana. Mike Solis forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. South, partly to mostly cloudy with a chance for showers and thunderstorms. Elsewhere, cloudy with areas of fog and drizzle and possibly a few isolated showers.